In matter of State versus Antoine Horton, can we please have appearances of counsel?
Good morning, Your Honors. Assistant Prosecutor Michelle Buckley from Union County Prosecutor's Office for the State.
And Whitney Flanagan, First Assistant Deputy Public Defender on behalf of Mr. Antoine Horton.
Welcome, counsel. Thank you for participating in this remote argument. And please know that Justice LaVecchia, who is not participating in the moment, will be on this case. She will review the recording afterwards. Ms. Flanagan, please go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors. I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal if necessary.
That's fine.
Thank you, Your Honor. One of the enduring hallmarks of a fair trial is a verdict that is unanimous and reached by the mutual deliberation of all 12 jurors. The unanimity and mutuality of deliberations are potentially at risk whenever a juror is replaced during deliberations. And that was particularly the case at Mr. Horton's trial, where a juror was substituted over strenuous objection after the jury had reached a partial verdict. The trial court's decision to permit substitution was counter to this court's clear precedent. This court has always held that once jury deliberations have progressed to determinations of guilt or innocence, juror substitution is no longer permissible. When a jury has announced that it has reached a partial verdict, it is self-evident that it has reached determinations of guilt or innocence. I would ask Your Honors to uphold that precedent and reverse Mr. Horton's conviction. And Your Honors, I didn't ask for an opening statement, so if you have questions at any point. The case law on this point has been clearly developed by this court. In Miller, the first case where this court approved of mid-deliberations juror substitution, the court also recognized that a situation could arise where it would be unwise to substitute a juror. And those circumstances came to pass in Corsaro, where this court held that once a jury has reached a partial verdict, juror substitution is no longer permissible. This court held that because the fact that a jury has deliberated to such an extent that it has reached verdicts on some means that deliberations have progressed too far to permit juror substitution. In Jenkins, that situation came to pass again. When a juror revealed to the court that the other 11 jurors had already reached a determination of guilt or innocence, deliberations had progressed too far. And although that juror could be removed, substitution at that point was impermissible. Just 6 years ago, this court decided Ross. And although in that decision, this court permitted juror substitution after an impasse, it did nothing to overturn holdings of Corsaro. The Ross decision is clear that when a partial verdict has been reached or circumstances otherwise that jurors have decided, or if the correct course of action is to declare a mistrial, not to substitute a juror.
Ms. Flanagan, I just want to remind everyone to hit mute if you're not speaking, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. When this court or any court needs to determine whether deliberations have progressed too far to permit substitution, the first place to look is communications from the jury itself.
Ms. Flanagan, please go ahead. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. I was saying that the first place that courts look to determine whether jury deliberations have progressed to the point of determinations of guilt or innocence is the communications from the jury itself. In Corsaro, the jury, much like in this case, told the court that it had reached a partial verdict. In Jenkins, one juror told the court that the other 11 had already reached a verdict. And those jury communications were dispositive evidence that deliberations had progressed too far to permit substitution. Looking at circumstantial evidence, like the amount of time a jury has deliberated before or after deliberations, is not as useful. It requires guesswork on the part of the court. And that's part of why this court has always held that there's no specific amount of time that means deliberations that have progressed too far. What the court should look to is whether determinations of fact or determinations of guilt or innocence have already been made.
Ms. Flanagan, may I ask you a question? You've aptly summarized our case law. In this situation, as you know, there is some evidence that the jury started over, for example, its request for a readback of testimony that it had previously heard before it was reconstituted with a substitute juror. Is there any room in our case law to consider that, and should there be?
Your Honor, I don't think there is. I don't think there should be. And I think even if the court considers the evidence in this case, it's not as persuasive as the state argues. Firstly, there is nothing in this court's precedent that indicates that once a jury has reached determinations of guilt or innocence, that any juror substitution at that point can be retroactively validated by whatever happens after deliberations. There's certainly no precedent to that effect. And I think the reason it really makes little sense to rely on something that happens afterward is twofold. One is that it really gives no guidance to trial courts about how to make these decisions when they come up. Trial courts can never know in advance what a jury is going to do after substitution. The other issue is that even when, as here, the jury deliberates for some time, requests read back of certain testimony, certain items of evidence, it still requires guesswork on the part of the court. So in the circumstances here, we don't know that the jury ever reconsidered the partial verdict reached by the initial jury. And the reason we don't know that is because the note that the jury originally sent out said that they had reached that partial verdict fairly quickly and had spent all of their time deliberating on the counts they disagreed on. So that's one indication that any continued deliberations might only be on those open counts, and they may never have reconsidered the partial verdict.
Should the court have taken a partial verdict? Could the court have taken a partial verdict and mistried the balance of the charges?
I think the court had that option at the time that the jury reported that they had a partial verdict. I think either decision would have been appropriate, either to take the partial verdict or what the court did do, which is ask the jurors to continue to deliberate. So that would have been an option for the court.
But in this case, are you suggesting that what the court should have done was at least take a partial verdict and declare a mistrial as to the remaining charges because the juror was being dismissed? Could they have done that? Would that have been appropriate?
It may have been appropriate to take the partial verdict. I think it would have required some additional instruction to the jury about the effect of the partial verdict prior.
This is Ms. Flanagan. The taking the partial verdicts is precisely what occurred in Coursera. But they were taken. The problem in Coursera then was permitting a substitution at that point and allowing the jury to consider the remaining charges, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Had the court not relieved the juror to go on vacation and taken the partial verdict, that would have been fine, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. This really wasn't exactly an issue in the case, so I believe there is subsequent case law that indicates a specific instruction has to be given in order to take the partial verdict, but yes, that would have been fine. I also wanted to address another aspect of the Chief Justice's question regarding that the jury asked for the same evidence both before and after the juror substitution.
Pause for a second. Let's pause for a second. Ms. Buckley, can you hear us?
We still can hear you. That's fine.
Okay.
Thank you.
Great. Let's go ahead. Thank you.
That's correct that they did ask for that piece of evidence. It was, I believe, the transcript of the testimony of a particular witness. But the jury actually asked for it three times. They asked for that piece of evidence before they were reached the partial verdict and the deadlock. They asked for it again after the note indicating they had a partial verdict and a deadlock. And then they asked for it again after the juror was substituted.
So I think if you look at that in combination with the note that the juror sent, which says we've spent all our time or most of our time looking at the charges that are still open, it seems clear that they considered this piece of evidence to be relevant to those open charges, since they asked for it again after they had said they had a deadlock and partial verdict. So the fact that the jury asked for it again after substitution does not indicate that they ever reconsidered the charges that were subject of the partial verdict. And that's really the concern, because the situation we're concerned about here is that, the jury is substituted. The juror goes back in the jury room. Even a conscientious jury that's trying to follow instructions, trying to reconsider, could say to that juror, listen, here's what we've deliberated on previously. We already reached a decision on counts A and B. Here's why we reached that decision. And the pressure on the substituted juror to say, yeah, that makes sense, to go along with that verdict, is very high. And if they do that, there's a couple concerns. One is that they didn't actually engage in the deliberations that resulted in that decision. And the second is that that juror may not be entirely comfortable with that previously reached verdict, perhaps because they didn't participate in the deliberations or because they have a different view of the evidence. So when we're talking about the risk to the unanimity and mutuality of the jury verdict, that's what we're talking about. And the risk of that happening in this case is high. And what this court has said is when there is a significant risk of that happening, we can't permit juror substitution. Because the fact that some jurors have already reached determinations of guilt or innocence means that that situation becomes quite likely and that deliberations have progressed too far for juror substitution. And the additional issue here is the possibility that the jurors simply felt that they had to come to a verdict. This was 10 days of deliberations, including, there was an initial juror substitution and instruction to begin anew prior to the note. Then there was a note indicating a partial verdict and a deadlock. And then there was a shocker charge given. And then there was an additional juror substitution and an instruction to begin anew. And as I note in my brief, that instruction did not include an instruction not to give up any honestly held views. The jury could have reasonably believed that it had to deliver a verdict. And the verdict that the jury did deliver indicates that this is a concern. This case involved a targeted shooting where someone unfortunately passed away. And the defense was one of identification, that Mr. Horton was not involved in the incident. And somehow he gets convicted, Mr. Horton is acquitted of the weapons offenses and convicted of reckless manslaughter and a lesser aggravated assault. This very well could have been a compromise verdict because the jury felt it had to come to a determination based on everything that happened during the course of these deliberations. I think that this court's case law is clear that once deliberations have become determinations of guilt or innocence, those deliberations have just progressed too far to permit juror substitution. And when Horton's jury announced that it had reached a partial verdict, it had by definition announced that it had reached factual and legal determinations, making substitution impossible. And the trial court erred in permitting that substitution. If the court has no further questions, I would just say ask this court to reverse. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Flanagan. Ms. Buckley. You need to unmute yourself, please.
Sorry.
Please go ahead.
Thank you. Okay, thank you. It is within a trial court's discretion to substitute a juror once deliberations have begun. While our case law has set guidelines for a trial court to follow in these circumstances, there is no bright line rule as to when substitution would be improper. That is because a trial court is in the best position to consider and evaluate all of the relevant factors when determining whether substitution is appropriate while still ensuring that the defendant receives a fair trial. In State v. Ross, this court addressed the appellate division's imposition of a per se rule regarding the substitution of a juror after the jury indicated it was deadlocked. The court specifically overruled State v. Banks in the appellate division decision to the extent that it generally barred trial courts from substituting a juror in that situation. In Ross, the court reiterated that what had been set forth in Shocker, namely that a previously deadlocked jury can conduct fair and effective deliberations, notwithstanding an earlier impasse. Applying that principle to the facts of Ross in their totality, the court determined that the reconstituted jury in that case, in fact, had engaged in fair and meaningful deliberations. The state submits that in this case, the trial court weighed all of the relevant factors, including the number of trial days and number of witnesses, as well as the amount of time the jury had been deliberating, and their ability to follow directions and properly substitute a juror for personal reasons unrelated to deliberations. Although the prior jury had indicated that it had reached a verdict on some of the charges but were split on others, given the totality of the circumstances, the substitution was not an abuse of discretion. I'm just going to continue on the audio. In fact, a review of the record clearly indicates that the newly constituted jury followed the court's specific and tailored instructions, began anew, and engaged in fair and meaningful deliberations. Specifically, the jury deliberated for 3 days, during which time, significantly, the jury requested new information that had not been sought by the original jury. Now, Ms. Flanagan had indicated that the jury had requested readback throughout the various stages of deliberations, but when the jury had been reconstituted for the final time, they asked for additional new information that had not been requested before, specifically information about the gun, which had not been requested by the previous impaneled jury. The jury deliberated for 3 days, they requested readback. The trial court was in the best position to observe this particular set of jurors, noted on more than one occasion that the jury was attentive, had followed previous instructions, and was not hesitant to ask questions. Thus, the substitution was appropriate. Looking at the totality of the circumstances, the appellate division correctly found that the trial court did not in substituting the juror at that point during deliberations. Thus, the state respectfully requests that this court affirm the decision of the appellate division.
Are you done with your opening statement, Ms. Buckley?
Yes, Judge.
Aren't you really asking us to reverse precedent here? The case law from Corsaro through Ross, which says, don't substitute a juror, quote, if there is a strong inference the jury has affirmatively reached a determination on one or more factual or legal issues. In this case, the note goes beyond that and tells us they actually reached a verdict on some counts. How can you prevail under existing precedent?
Well, Judge, I think that the existing precedent indicates that that's not something that should be done, but it's not something that must not be done. So I would say that the precedent does not provide a hard and fast per se rule that courts should follow. And the reason for that and why I think that that's a good thing given the circumstances is because the trial court is in the best position to make that determination. If it were to be found that after a jury indicated that there could never be, that they had a partial verdict, that there could never be a substitution of jurors, it could lead to circumstances where courts would necessarily take a partial verdict for fear that if something happened to the juror, any of the jurors over lunch or over a break, that would be a mistrial. And therefore, to avoid having to declare a mistrial, particularly in a case like this, where there was so much testimony and the case.
Ms. Buckley, yes. I know that you mentioned the totality of the circumstances approach in Ross, and we did say that, but with certain exceptions, taking into consideration our pre-existing case law, as mentioned by the Chief Justice. And this is language from Corsaro, and I'd like you to respond to it. Third, and I'm quoting, if a partial verdict has been rendered or the circumstances otherwise suggest that jurors have decided one or more issues in the case, the trial court should not authorize a jurored substitution, but should declare a mistrial. What could be clearer than that as an instruction to our trial courts?
The language that's used in that particular part indicates that the trial court should not replace the juror. However, it doesn't indicate that there is a hard rule, that there is a full stop. So for that reason, it's the state's position.
Where is the light in that language that suggests that there isn't a full stop?
I would say should not would be the language that would indicate that it's not a full stop, should, rather than must not or may never, which in Ross, this court indicated that there was no rule that a juror may never be substituted when the jury has indicated that it's reached that it was deadlocked. So there was clearly a distinction in Ross between never and should not would be the position that I would take to indicate that there is not a bright line rule that would not enable a judge to make that determination. I think there are other significant issues that occurred, events that occurred during the deliberation process in this jury as a whole. There were three basic significant events. First was the replacement of juror number four, which happened on April 19th. And there's no question that juror was missed because she was ill. The second occurred when the jurors sent out a note that they had reached a decision on some charges but were split on others. But it's important to note that after that note is delivered about the partial verdict, they receive the shocker charge, and then they return to deliberations for three additional days. Now, Justice Alvin, you had asked
So Ms. Flanagan pointed out, we don't know what they spent their time on. They may have spent 2 minutes on the partial verdicts and may have spent the rest of the time on the charges that were giving them problems. And isn't that the problem, that we just can't be? Can you continue to hear us?
Yes.
The problem is we're in the realm of complete speculation as to what the jury was doing. But what we do know is our case law has said it's unreasonable to expect jurors who've already rendered a verdict to reconsider something that they've already determined as a group. So why don't you respond to that?
Sure. Well, I think that the fact that this jury did, in fact, take three additional days, asked for significant readback, and asked for new information indicates that they did indeed take that charge very seriously and did, in fact, go back and deliberate on, I would submit, all of the issues. So for that reason, I think that to say that they're incapable, I don't think that the jury was incapable.
How can you say that they considered all of the issues? We just don't know. That's entire speculation. Would you agree?
I think that there is evidence that would, in looking at the notes that were sent out, there's evidence that they did in fact look to new evidence, and I think that that's indicative of the fact that there was a new person that had been injected into this jury. There was a request for readback of testimony that had previously been requested, and in addition, there was a request for testimony with regard to the gun. Up until that point, in all of the deliberations with the various jurors, there was no request for any evidence with regard to the gun. And in fact, there was no evidence that was presented with regard to a gun. That was something that was brought into the case during a defense counsel's summation. So it indicates that there was another juror, that the injection of this other juror brought questions about the gun, which previously had not been requested, even after all of the requested readbacks. So I do think that there's an indication that they were reevaluating and looking at all of the charges in their completion. There were questions about the credibility of the state's main witness, David Rivera. There were questions about the timing. There were questions about the defendant's conduct in terms of the testimony about the defendant's conduct after he had learned of the burglary at his home. All of those things were important, but here in the final panel of the jury, you have a question about the gun, which had not been raised before. So I think that is suggestive that this panel, this jury panel, did in fact look at other evidence besides what had been determined before.
If your analysis is correct, what is a trial judge to do? Wait to see, allow a substitution, and then wait days later to evaluate whether that was a sensible way to proceed?
If I understand, wait days later during deliberations or wait until after a verdict, Judge? I'm sorry.
Wait until the end of deliberations, because your analysis is based on how you interpret what followed the application or the moment of decision to substitute a juror.
Well, I do think that it would be then to wait and to charge the jury to start again and to see whether or not the jury has listened to that charge. In all of the case law leading up to this, there's an assessment of whether or not the jury in fact was able to deliberate. There's an examination of the timing. How long had they deliberated before, and how long had they deliberated after the juror was replaced? And when it's found that after the substitution, deliberations only occurred for a brief period of time, it was found that that really wasn't a meaningful exchange of ideas. That was not a meaningful deliberation, and that the verdict was vacated. So I think that there's room for that ability to charge the jury and allow the process to play out and allow the jury to take their time. Certainly, if the jury had returned a verdict in 15 minutes, then that would have been indicative that they had not followed the judge's instruction. And the trial court even acknowledged as much. When she replaced the jury, she indicated, if they come back in 20 minutes, we know they haven't listened. But they did, in fact, listen. So I think these facts are unique and significant. And I think it's important to look at the facts, because in all of the case law that examines whether a judge has abused his or her discretion, the totality of the circumstances are examined. And it is important to note what happens before and, in fact, what happens after in determining whether or not the judge abused its discretion. And these are very fact-sensitive issues, which a bright-line rule would remove that discretion, that ability of a judge to view the panel as a whole, to decide whether or not, or determine whether or not they would be able to follow directions and the charge to start anew. Also,
Ms. Buckley, other states don't take the approach that this court has taken from Corsaro through Ross. Are you arguing in any way that there are reasons for the court to rethink that line of case law, or are you simply saying that applying the standards as you read them, you should prevail?
I think that applying the standards and looking at the totality of the circumstances as the previous case law has, that this defendant did receive a fair trial, the jury did engage in a fair deliberation process, and that the state should then prevail. What the state's position is that there should not, the discretion of the court should not be removed.
Miss, can you continue to hear us, Miss Buckley?
And yes.
Mm-hmm. So whenever a juror is removed, at that point in time, a court has to make the decision whether or not substitution is permissible. Our case law has said when the minds of the jurors who are remaining on the jury are closed, that's not possible. So what better indicator is there that their minds are closed than the fact that they've already returned verdicts?
Well, Justice Alvin, the verdict had not been returned. And I think the fact that the verdict had not been returned indicates that there's still room for them to reconsider their decisions. Implicit in the model jury charge for partial verdicts, there's a recognition that the jury has the potential to reevaluate the decisions that they've already made. And there's the instruction that once they render that decision, that is the final decision. They cannot go back and reevaluate it. I think inherent in that is the understanding that even if a jury has come to a partial verdict without disclosing what that verdict is, there's still the ability to revisit that decision, whether it's through another juror coming in and indicating a new perspective, a question about evidence that hadn't been considered before, causing other jurors to reevaluate their situation.
Why isn't the better route the route that both Justice Solomon and Justice Alvin talked about, and that is take the partial verdict and declare a mistrial on the remaining counts? Isn't that the safest course?
Well, I think that would lead to a lot of cases where it's where a partial verdict is rendered unnecessarily or prematurely. In this case, when the jury indicated that it had reached a partial verdict, the trial court observed that even though they had been deliberating for a certain number of days, they really had only been discussing the evidence for 5 hours. And given the length of the trial, the number of witnesses, the amount of evidence, this was a complicated trial. There were numerous gross hearings, but that was not enough time to take this partial verdict, that it was premature at that time. So the trial court did make the observation, they haven't been going at this long enough to really take this partial verdict at this time. And that is why, and it was with the consent of both the state and defense counsel, that rather than give the partial verdict charge, the court and counsel agreed that the jury should get the chakra charge. So there wasn't an assessment of the jury at that time that it was premature and they hadn't really assessed all of the evidence completely. So I think that it would, in that case, to take the partial verdict would have been premature.
Ms. Buckley, should we really be concerned that judges are going to take partial verdicts prematurely? Every incentive they have after having spent time conducting a trial is not to let that jury go, to allow for more time. Do you have examples, or are you aware of situations where judges are taking premature partial verdicts?
I don't have experience where judges are prematurely taking partial verdicts, but I think if there is the additional stressor that if anything happens to this jury, then there's a mistrial, I think that absolutely will impact a court's decision as to whether or not to just accept a partial verdict, even if it's prematurely, in order to avoid having a mistrial, particularly when the trial has gone on for a significant amount of time and there had been a lot of resources expended. I also have had personally the experience where a jury indicated that it had reached a partial verdict, was given the Shocker charge to go back in and continue deliberating, and changed its verdict on the verdict sheet from guilty to not guilty. So there is I have personal anecdotal experience where, unfortunately, the jury changed its mind on a previously determined verdict and actually went from guilty to not guilty on a particular charge after hearing additional readback.
Questions, anyone? Is there anything you'd like to add, Ms. Buckley?
Nothing, Your Honor. Just that the state respectfully requests that this court affirm the decision of the appellate division affirming defendant's conviction. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Flanagan, rebuttal?
Just very briefly, Your Honors. I just, you know, wanted to point out that, you know, in its brief, the state argued that the fact that the jury looked at the same evidence before and after substitution indicated they had reconsidered. Now the state is arguing that looking at different evidence means that they reconsidered. And I think this just goes to sort of the speculation that's required to read too much into what happens after a jury says it's reached a unanimous verdict on some counts. And I did just want to draw the court's attention to footnote 3 of Corsaro, which does say that if juror substitution after a partial verdict is ever permitted, it could only be if fact-finding on the open charges are so completely divorced from fact-findings on the partial verdict. And there's no way to say that that's the case here. Firstly, we don't know what counts they reached a verdict on, but also all of the counts were interrelated. So I think that Corsaro does control the outcome of this case. I would ask Your Honors to follow that precedent and to reverse Mr. Horton's conviction. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Flanagan. Thank you, counsel.